The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 3rd, 2024 issue of the Week. This week's cover drawing looks like a Ukrainian battlefield. We see Volodymyr Zelensky standing in front of a artillery gun. Looks like he's in battle gear and manning the gun. And there's a supply truck, and House Speaker Mike Johnson is unloading artillery shells, and he's handing one of the shells to Zelensky. They're looking at each other. The headline is The Good Fight, Why Johnson Risked His Job to Secure Aid for Ukraine. That is our first main story. We will start right there. Congress passes long-delayed Ukraine-Israel aid. What happened? A $95.3 billion aid package, including desperately needed weapons and munitions for Ukraine, was signed into law by President Biden this week after a bipartisan alliance of lawmakers overcame months of resistance from isolationist Republicans. House Speaker Mike Johnson defied threats to his speakership from GOP hardliners by bringing four bills to the floor, which collectively mirrored a $95 billion aid bill passed by the Senate in February, one that Johnson had refused to bring up for a vote. The bills included $60.8 billion for Ukraine, $26.4 billion for Israel and Gaza humanitarian aid, and $8.1 billion to counter Chinese threats against Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. A fourth bill, added to draw conservative support, includes a provision giving the Chinese owner of the social media site TikTok 9 months to sell or face a possible U.S. ban. All passed handily with bipartisan support. The Ukraine bill was approved 311 to 112. All the no votes were Republicans. Sent to the Senate as a single package, the package passed 79 to 18. It was a difficult path, Biden said after signing the legislation, but in the end, we did what America always does. We rose to the moment. Aid for Ukraine will arrive at a critical time for the embattled U.S. ally, which is running low on stocks of crucial weapons and is facing relentless Russian attacks. CIA Director Bill Burns told Congress that Ukraine could lose by year's end without new aid. General Christopher Cavoli, head of the U.S. European Command, said Ukrainian artillery was being outshot by the Russian side 5-1. Such testimony helped convince Johnson to push the aid forward over the opposition of right-wing representatives who, with Donald Trump's encouragement, have variously opposed any Ukraine aid or insisted it be tied to border security measures. This is not a game, said Johnson. History will judge us. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene accused Johnson of a complete surrender to Democrats and vowed to push through a measure to oust him from the speakership. At least two fellow Republicans said they'd back the effort. Others said they'd consider it. He's fallen right in line with the swamp, said Representative Eli Crane, Republican from Arizona. What the editorial said. The bipartisan effort was a victory for both Ukraine and functional American governance, said the Chicago Tribune. Trump, a devoted fan of Russian President Vladimir Putin, did his best to block Ukraine aid, and his stranglehold on the MAGA caucus meant we inexcusably left Kyiv hanging for months. But a rock-ribbed conservative from Louisiana summoned the courage to defy his party's extremists and push through aid that serves vital American interest. Johnson deserves immense credit for risking his political future in service to his country. This was a show of will from the U.S. that will reverberate around the world, said the Wall Street Journal. While we celebrate dodging a geopolitical disaster, we must call out the 14 House GOP isolationists who voted against all four aid bills and the 15 GOP senators who voted no. Apparently, they think we should ignore allies threatened by authoritarians on the march, like the 1930s Republicans who slept while Hitler and Tojo advanced. They lost this time, but this GOP tendency is dangerous. What the columnist said. Johnson's decision to back the aid package after months of opposition was the culmination of a remarkable personal and political arc, said Katie Edmondson in the New York Times. He met with top national security officials and broad factions of GOP voters. He thought about his son, who's bound for the U.S. Naval Academy, and he prayed for guidance. Ultimately, he was moved by descriptions from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and others of the magnitude of misery Russia has unleashed in Ukraine, and their warning that Putin's expansionist aims pose a broader threat in Europe and beyond. Johnson then became part of an extensive effort to convince Trump not to sabotage the bill, said Jonathan Martin, Politico. Former cabinet officials, retired generals, Republican lawmakers, and foreign officials, including British Foreign Minister David Cameron and Polish President Andrzej Duda, all made an aggressive case, many during trips to Mar-a-Lago. In one prong of the successful effort, Johnson and other Republicans warned Trump that if Kyiv fell, he'd take office in January to a crisis overseas. The House Speaker has no profile in courage, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. To praise Johnson as a hero ignores the immense damage he and House pro-Russian propagandists inflicted on our suffering allies, who were left twisting in the wind as MAGA lawmakers blocked aid that had wide bipartisan support. Delivered sooner, it could have prevented countless Ukrainian deaths and avoided a damaging blow to America's global credibility. The loss in Ukrainian lives, territory, infrastructure, and morale has been enormous, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic. It's helped feed the narrative of failure disseminated by pro-Russia influencers such as Tucker Carlson and Senator J.D. Vance. But now they and the Kremlin have been dealt a severe setback, and U.S. arms will again start flowing to Ukraine. It's time to settle in for a long fight ahead and redouble our commitment to Putin's defeat. The GOP's pro-Russia caucus lost. Now Ukraine has to win. Controversy of the week. Colleges cracking down on anti-Semitism or on free speech. When New York police cleared a Gaza solidarity encampment from the grounds of Columbia University last week, arresting some 100 peaceful protesters, Columbia President Manoush Shafiq likely thought she'd saved her job, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. A day earlier, Shafiq had appeared before a House committee investigating campus anti-Semitism, the same GOP-led panel whose December grilling of the presidents of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania resulted in both women being driven from their jobs. Unlike the defensive Claudine Gay and Liz McGill, Shafiq readily agreed with her Republican inquisitors that some pro-Palestinian activism at Columbia had crossed the line into anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish students, and said she was cracking down. Soon after, she invited the NYPD onto campus. It wasn't enough for Republican lawmakers, who demanded Shafiq resign over her failure to protect Jewish students. Meanwhile, her crackdown inspired protest at Yale, Harvard, Michigan, Berkeley, and Columbia, where undaunted students established a new encampment. Good for them, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Republicans are waging the greatest assault on campus free speech since the heyday of McCarthyism. Students need to channel the golden age of campus protest in the 1960s and fight back. This isn't about free speech, said National Review in an editorial. Shafiq only took action when the implicitly anti-Semitic rallies that followed Hamas' massacre of some 1,200 Israelis on October 7th evolved into something more explicit. In recent weeks, Jewish Columbia students have been cursed at, shoved, spat upon, and encircled by masked and Kiev-wearing protesters telling them to go back to Poland or to chanting, "Burn Tel Aviv to the ground." In 26 years on Columbia's faculty, I've never seen the ugly face of anti-Semitism expose itself like this, said David Schizer in CNN.com. When students' political expression stops other students from learning, classes were held virtually this week after a campus rabbi urged Jewish students to stay home for their own safety. Administrators have a legal and moral imperative to intervene. That's honestly ridiculous, said Columbia student Melaine Klein in Slate. Yes, the sheer size of the Columbia protest and the excesses of a few outside agitators may have made some pro-Israel Jewish students feel swamped and uncomfortable. But these are explicitly protests against Israel, not against Jews. Can we really not understand these protests without conjuring the specter of anti-Jewish animus? Asked Moira Donegan in The Guardian. It is so hard to believe that students might be sincerely outraged by the deaths of tens of thousands of people in Gaza. The outrage is sincere, said Michael Powell in The Atlantic. But at Columbia this week, I witnessed a fervor that went beyond compassion. Hearing protesters inside the liberated zone casually call for the elimination of Israel, I sensed many had allowed the intoxicating language of liberation to blind them to an ugliness encoded within that struggle. The Palestinian cause needs American advocates, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. The tragedy is that many student advocates have allied themselves with death cults like Hamas. The student protesters don't want peace, but a righteous war that ends with Israel's obliteration. Their objection is not to human suffering across the board, but rather that the wrong humans are suffering. It's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for safe sex. After New York City lawmakers began considering a bill to dose the metropolis' booming rat population with a new contraceptive named ContraPest. The drug's inventor, Dr. Loretta Mayer, says the birth control pellets taste better than pizza. It was a good week for metal after Metallica's James Hetfield unveiled a new tattoo made from ink infused with the ashes of late Motorhead frontman Lemmy Kilmister. Hetfield said the tattoo, an ace of spades on his middle finger, will ensure Lenny can still fly the bird at the world. And it was a good week for undrafted free agents. After New Orleans Saints owner Gail Benson gave Pope Francis a personalized jersey during a visit to the Vatican. Francis, 87, has a history of knee issues, but the Saints badly need depth behind oft-injured right tackle Ryan Ramczyk. But it was a bad week for specimens after Australian health officials pleaded with the public to stop bringing the snakes that just bit them to the ER. Medical workers are actually not trained to identify snakes, said Dr. Adam Michael. It just puts the staff at risk as well as yourself. It's a bad week for the caretaker. After a mysterious blaze erupted in the attic of Oregon's historic Timberline Lodge, featured in Stanley Kubrick's 1980 horror classic, The Shining. Management said swift action by firefighters saved the lodge from a much worse outcome. Finally, it was a bad week for old school pranks. After a 17-year-old in Baldwinsville, New York, was arrested and expelled for impersonating his high school principal in a resignation announcement sent by a fax. The student was caught because he listed his own cell phone number on the fax cover sheet. Moving over to the briefing, titled this week, Project 2025's Radical Agenda. Conservative groups have crafted a sweeping plan to remake the government and the U.S. in a second Trump term. What is Project 2025? Drawn up by the Heritage Foundation and a network of more than 100 other conservative groups, the 2025 Presidential Transition Project is an elaborate and painstakingly detailed agenda for a second Donald Trump administration. In a 920-page manifesto titled Mandate for Leadership, Heritage head Kevin Roberts says Project 2025's goal is to combat cultural Marxism and rescue our kids, reclaim our culture, revive our economy, and defeat the anti-American left. To do that, the initiative calls for thousands of conservative activists to be placed in federal agencies, an aggressive expansion in presidential power, and the imposition of pro-life, pro-religion, anti-immigrant, anti-environmental policies on the nation. In essence, Project 2025 is a playbook to avoid the failures of the first Trump administration, when pushback from bureaucrats and cabinet members, as well as Trump's own chaotic approach, prevented many hard right policies from being implemented. The mistakes of those years must never be repeated, said Roberts, who has described his goal as institutionalizing Trumpism. How would it work? The first step would be the mass firing of civil servants and their replacement with MAGA loyalists. The manifesto calls for the reintroduction of Schedule F, a Trump-era executive order that would allow up to 50,000 nonpartisan federal workers to be reclassified as political appointees and then fired at will by the president. Backed by tens of millions of dollars from donors, Project 2025 is vetting potential administration recruits with the aim of having up to 20,000 candidates in a database by the end of the year. That army will begin dismantling the administrative state from day one of a new Trump term, said Roberts. With obstructionist bureaucrats removed, Project 2025 could focus on other concerns. The Justice Department, for example, would fall under the president's direct control, opening the door for Trump to pursue his promised retribution against adversaries, including President Biden. What's the plan for abortion? Mandate for Leadership outlines a wholesale crackdown on reproductive rights. Every U.S. state would be required to tell the Department of Health and Human Services exactly how many abortions take place within its borders, at what gestational age of the child, for what reason, the mother's state of residence, and by what method. FDA approved for the abortion pill mifepristone would be rescinded, while the 150-year-old Comstock Act, which criminalizes the mailing of drugs or devices used in abortions, would be resurrected. Employers would be allowed to decline contraceptive coverage on religious and moral grounds. Sensing this agenda could be a vote loser in November, some conservative activists have called for those involved in Project 2025 to stay quiet on abortion. Pro-life groups should keep their mouths shut as much as possible until the election, said former Trump lawyer Jonathan F. Mitchell. How about immigration? Project 2025 calls for the indefinite curtailment of refugee admissions, using the military to arrest undocumented migrants at the border and massive cutbacks in legal immigration. Some 500,000 so-called dreamers, undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, would lose their legal shield from deportation. Not mentioned in the manifesto are even more draconian proposals supported by Trump and other Project 2025 figures, including the repeal of birthright citizenship for children born in the U.S. to undocumented migrants and sweeping immigration raids on workplaces and neighborhoods. Local police officers and National Guard troops would be deputized to help round up undocumented migrants who would be held at vast military-built detention camps. Trump would circumvent the Posse Comitatus Act, which bars the use of the armed forces for domestic law enforcement, by invoking the Insurrection Act, said Stephen Miller, who spearheaded immigration policy in Trump's first term. Bottom line, said Miller, Trump will do whatever it takes. Does Project 2025 have an economic plan? Some proposals in Mandate for Leadership follow a traditional conservative approach. Social Security could be privatized, the document notes, and personal and corporate taxes slashed. Extreme green policies would be axed. That includes the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, which directs some $400 billion in federal funds to support the clean energy transition. Project 2025 also recommends the shuttering or repurposing of numerous offices connected to climate science and renewable energy, loosening the Endangered Species Act, and expanding oil and gas drilling in the Arctic. Could this really happen? Many Project 2025 proposals would be vulnerable to legal challenges, and it's not clear whether Trump is on board with the entire plan. He often appears driven more by approval than ideology, and some of the initiatives are deeply unpopular and more extreme than Trump's own positions. His campaign routinely notes that Trump has not endorsed Project 2025 and that policy proposals from allied outside groups are speculative and theoretical. Still, Trump has spoken at length about launching the government takeover that's central to Heritage's plans. We will throw off the sick political class that hates our country, he declared last year. What is clear is that conservative groups are determined to arm Trump with the agenda needed to achieve his goals and theirs. Project 2025, said Harvard political scientist Theda Skocpol, is full prep for an authoritarian takeover. And a few of the best columns. We will read two from the U.S. The media's failure on trans issues. The media has failed miserably in its coverage of gender-affirming medical treatments for teens, said Jesse Singal. Most news organizations responded to the legitimate debate over these treatments with credulous activism-infused journalism, adopting the mantra that it was settled science that minors with gender dysphoria should be treated with puberty blockers, hormones, and even surgery. But in a recent study, British pediatrician Hilary Cass found no good evidence to support giving powerful life-altering hormones to preteens and teens with gender-related distress. Cass doesn't oppose such treatment in all cases. She argues simply that the skyrocketing number of minors requesting them should receive the proper screening and assessment before medical interventions are undertaken. In Europe, progressive countries like the UK, Finland, and Sweden have already turned away from medical interventions, except in rare cases. But in the U.S., the Cass report has been virtually ignored by major media outlets, including CNN, NBC News, and Scientific American. Why? Their staffs fear being branded as transphobic, far-right bigots by activists who warn that undermining gender-affirming care would literally lead to the mass suicide of trans preteens and teens. These bullying activists and their media defenders hope Cass' report will fade away, but it won't. A curious way to save democracy. In a recent poll, 7 out of 10 Americans agreed that democracy is currently under threat, said E.J. Dionne. Is this a rare moment of kumbaya bipartisan consensus? Quite the opposite. Drill down a bit more, and what concerns Republicans is that it's become too easy to cast ballots, with 82% of them saying they're worried about widespread voter fraud. Among Democrats, 76% are concerned about laws and practices that Republican-run states have adopted to make it harder to vote. To pander to the Trumpist right, House Speaker Mike Johnson recently called for federal legislation requiring proof of citizenship from every voter. But it's already illegal for non-citizens to vote, and there is no evidence, zip, that fraud is a problem in our system. Multiple studies by the Brennan Center for Justice found that the actual voter fraud rate falls somewhere between 0.0003 and 0.0025%. In 2020, the expansion of early and mail balloting produced a record turnout, with Trump getting 11.2 million more votes than he got 4 years earlier. But Biden got 7 million more votes than Trump. The Republican solution? Make sure fewer people vote. This column comes from Italy. Don't joke about Catholic dogma. A cheeky potato chip commercial set in a convent? For Catholics in Italy, it's no laughing matter, said Bruno Ballardini. The Amica chips spot shows a young novice receiving communion. As the priest places the wafer in her mouth, there's a loud crunching sound. Panic. The nun's eyes widen. The wafer must never be chewed, only swallowed. Cut to the Mother Superior sitting nearby, munching away from a bag of chips. It was she who issued the unholy crunch. Funny, right? But no, the heavens have opened up. Pronouncing the ad blasphemous, a Catholic media watchdog wants it yanked off the air. Christ reduced to a potato chip, proclaimed an outraged editorial in the Catholic newspaper Avenir. Debased and vilified like 2,000 years ago. Some Catholics are steamed by the ad slogan, Amiga Chips, the everyday divine. But most are fuming over an online spoof that shows the Mother Superior dumping potato chips into the communion vessel, a scene that never actually aired on TV. They're harumphing in knee-jerk righteousness over a blasphemy that never was. These Catholics profess to be shocked. I am the one who is shocked by an overreaction worthy of the most violent Islamic fundamentalism. Can't anyone take a joke? And it's time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. Abortion goes back to the shadows. Women seeking abortions in states where the procedure is banned must now rely on mail order pills and volunteer hotlines, said Caroline Kitchener in the Washington Post. The experience is often traumatic. Angel tucked two white pills into each side of her mouth, bracing herself as they begin to dissolve. Her deepest fears and anxieties took over. Angel had wanted to talk to a doctor before she took the pills to end her pregnancy. worried about how they might interact with medication she took for her heart condition. But in her home state of Oklahoma, where almost all abortions are banned, that wasn't an option. The pain kicked in after about an hour, around midnight on Sunday, eventually becoming sharp enough that the 23-year-old said she struggled to stand. While Angel would be fine by the next morning, she worried that something might be very wrong as she lay on the cold bathroom tile, her body racked by some of the worst pain she could remember. When Angel's fiancé came in to check on her, she was having diarrhea while vomiting into their popcorn bowl. "F," she remembers yelling over and over, "I feel like I need to push." Overwhelming evidence shows that abortion pills are safe and effective, and that many patients who take them go through the process without much difficulty, experiencing little more than the sharp cramping and bleeding of an unusually heavy period. That is true even when the pills approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, with a prescription for use through 10 weeks of pregnancy, are taken somewhat independently, administered by a doctor over text, email, or a call and mail to the patient at home. But the experience can feel very different in states where abortion is illegal. As more women in states with abortion bans choose to end their pregnancies on their own without directly interacting with a medical professional, they are thrust into a largely ad hoc, unregulated system of online and grassroots abortion pill distributors, an experience that, while deemed generally safe by medical experts, can be confusing, scary, and at times deeply traumatic. "This is not the way healthcare should be," said Linda Prine, a New York-based doctor who prescribes pills through Aid Access, a Europe-based online clinic that now sends the pills to at least 6,000 women every month in states with bans. Prine co-founded a hotline for people taking them. "All the options have been taken away from people by these bans, and this is all that's left," she added, referring to the networks providing pills for women self-managing their abortions. "It really is all we can do." Adding to the difficulty is a polarized political debate with dueling narratives about what it's actually like to take abortion pills. Anti-abortion activists say the pills are highly dangerous or even deadly for pregnant women. False assertions based largely on studies that have now been retracted by the journal that published them. Meanwhile, many abortion rights advocates describe the experience as straightforward and easy to handle on your own, a characterization that some women say glosses over what can be more complicated reality of ending a pregnancy alone in your bathroom. "I wish I would have known that it wasn't just blood clots. I was really confused and shocked," said Brianna, a 34-year-old in Alabama, who took pills she ordered online when she was at least 5 weeks beyond the FDA's 10-week limit. Like other women interviewed for this article, Brianna spoke on the condition that her last name not be used so she could discuss sensitive medical information in a state that outlaws abortion, describing her experience in graphic detail because she said she wanted other women to know what to expect. In Oklahoma, Angel ordered her pills from Aid Access and took them 5 to 6 weeks into her pregnancy. She told doctors at the online clinic about her heart medication when she filled out its online form, she said, but no one ever reached out about it. "A silence easily explained," Prine said, "because Angel's medication is not one that would raise concerns." Angel had no way of knowing that. Sitting on the toilet, she could hear her heart pounding in her ears. She placed two fingers on the side of her neck to take her pulse and started a timer, she recalled, counting about 190 beats per minute. With her heart condition, she said, she was supposed to seek medical attention if her heart rate got that high. Angel had no idea who to call. She vaguely remembered a hotline number in the Aid Access instructions, but figured the line would be closed that time of night. The hospital didn't feel like an option either. She worried about the questions she might get from suspicious doctors if she showed up at the emergency room. She closed her eyes and tried to steady her breath, determined to keep her heart rate down. Then she spoke to herself as she imagined a doctor might. "You will be okay," said Angel, who would wake up the next morning no longer pregnant, the worst moments of her abortion behind her. "This pain can't last forever." A semi-retired family medicine physician, Prine co-founded the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline in 2019 as a resource for people self-managing miscarriages or abortions at home. Calls to the hotline surged after Texas enacted an early law banning most abortions in the fall of 2021, Prine said, and again after new abortion bans took effect across the South and Midwest when Roe fell. Now the line is staffed by over 50 U.S.-based medical providers who volunteer their time, a mix of doctors, midwives, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants with experience in abortion care. By design, the hotline volunteers don't ask for the name, locations, or full medical histories of the people who call. The hotline typically receives roughly 30 calls and 50 texts from people every day. Many say they are in states that ban abortion. For those who choose to self-manage their abortions, Prine said, she is there to offer reassurance that their experiences are nothing out of the ordinary and that they almost certainly don't need to go to the emergency room. A medication abortion is just like a miscarriage, she'll tell them, with hundreds of women going through the same process every day. Of the approximately 5.9 million patients in the United States who took mifepristone, the first drug in a two-step medication abortion regimen, between its 2000 approval and December 2022, just 32 died, according to the FDA. Those cases, the agency said, cannot with certainty be causally attributed to mifepristone. Major adverse events, in which a blood transfusion, major surgery, or overnight hospital stay is required, occur in fewer than 0.5% of cases, a figure that remains the same whether or not a patient has met with a doctor in person. On the hotline, Prine says she's felt the need to send someone to the emergency room only once in nearly 5 years. At her home in Alabama, Brianna waited to take the pills until she'd put all of her children to sleep. The cramps in her lower back came first, followed by full-body chills and eventually contractions more painful than those she remembered from childbirth. After lying in bed for 2 hours, Brianna felt something pop under the comforter, followed by a gush of warm liquid seeping down her legs. She ran to the bathroom, she recalled in interviews and a journal entry, where she felt a mass larger than her palm drop into the toilet. "This can't be happening," she thought to herself. Then she looked down to see a bloody umbilical cord dangling between her legs. When the pills first arrived in the mail a few days earlier in April 2023, Brianna had expected her experience would be more difficult than most. The doctors who administered the medication through Aid Access cautioned Brianna that they do not like to recommend medical abortions as far into pregnancy as she would be when the pills reached her. Brianna felt she had no choice. By the time she found out she was pregnant, she was already 11 or 12 weeks along. The abortion clinic she'd called in a different state, more than a six-hour drive from her home in Alabama, where abortion is banned, was booked for surgical procedures for over a month, busy treating patients from other anti-abortion states across the South. She spent nearly 2 weeks researching her other options. Then the pills she ordered took 2 weeks to arrive. The 34-year-old was struggling to support the kids she already had. "I didn't want to take any more away from them. Time, attention, money," said Brianna, who estimates that she was 15 or 16 weeks along when she took the pills. According to data compiled by Aid Access, 1 in 20 patients who responded to the organization's survey in January took the pills beyond 11 weeks of pregnancy. 1 in 100 took the pills beyond 13 weeks. About 20% of people who took the pills responded to the survey. Still, Prine said, she has fielded far more of these calls from women later in pregnancy than she would like, averaging one a day on the hotline in the months after the Supreme Court decision. Some of the callers had no idea how far along they were until they passed the pregnancy, she said. Others knew, but chose to go ahead anyway. Beyond 12 or 13 weeks, women will see a much more developed fetus with identifiable features. We hear the trauma when we talk to people, Prine said. It's an image you can't get out of your head. Alone in her bathroom, Brianna had no idea what to do. The aid access doctors had told her to expect nausea, vomiting, chills, blood clots, and a fetus at least the size of an orange, emails show. They said nothing about the umbilical cord. Do I pull the cord out? Brianna wondered, frantically trying to remember what the doctors had done when she gave birth. Do I just wait to try to push it out? Her boyfriend was sleeping in the next room. Even if she woke him up, she wondered, what could he do? If she went to the emergency room, she said she felt sure she'd be prosecuted. Finally, Brianna decided to call the number for the miscarriage and abortion hotline she'd seen in an email from Aid Access. That's the placenta you need to push out, Brianna recalled the woman on the hotline saying. When you feel the next contraction, I want you to push like you're giving birth. Brianna said she sat there with the umbilical cord hanging loose for at least 15 minutes before the placenta finally dropped into the toilet. As difficult as the situation was, Brianna said she is extremely grateful that Aid Access was willing to send her the pills and that someone on the hotline was available to talk her through taking them. Without the hotline, I would have been completely lost and literally completely alone, she said. The lady stayed talking to me for hours, Brianna said. I wish I knew her name. Brianna stayed in the bathroom that night for more than an hour. She knew she shouldn't look at the fetus, she said, but she couldn't help it. In the toilet bowl, she couldn't make out a head. She remembered thinking that the legs looked long. I felt like a monster, she said, reflecting back on that moment. A year later, Brianna said she is certain she made the right decision for herself and her family. But she wishes someone had told her more about what to expect. If she had known the full extent of what could happen during a medication abortion at 15 or 16 weeks, she said, she probably would have searched harder for an out-of-state clinic with available appointments. And she figured out a way to drive 6 hours or more to Florida, Illinois, or North Carolina. Before Roe v. Wade was overturned, Brianna could have gone to a clinic less than 30 minutes from her house. A version of this story was first published in the Washington Post. Here's one of the obituaries. The guitarist who was born a rambling man. Dickie Betts, 1943 to 2024. Dickie Betts was such a quintessential rock star. His hair long, his talent electric, and his attitude rebellious, that they modeled the guitarist in the 2000 film Almost Famous explicitly after him. As co-lead guitarist for the Allman Brothers Band, he helped shape its blend of rock, jazz, blues, and country into a new genre, Southern rock. He wrote and sang several of the band's most popular songs, including 1973's Ramblin' Man, the ode to an unencumbered life on the road that was the Allman Brothers' biggest hit. The band played hard and often butted heads, breaking up and getting back together multiple times. When five or six guys are together working intensely, they can really get into some duels, Betts said in 1989. We had our spats and fights and knock-em-down dragouts. Born in West Palm Beach, Florida, Forrest Richard Betts was the son of a fiddler, said the Rolling Stone. He picked up the ukulele at age 5 and then added mandolin and banjo before landing on guitar as a teen in hopes of impressing girls. As he began kicking around in bands, he met guitarist Dwayne Allman, who invited him to join a new venture alongside his brother Greg in 1969. Dwayne Allman and Betts took rock guitar improvisation and two guitar dueling to new heights, and the band continued after Dwayne's death in 1971 with Greg as leader. But as Betts' musical reputation increased, so did his wild streak, said the Washington Post. He started speeding around on motorcycles and trashing hotel rooms. At one point, he took a swing at a cop. Another time, he shot a cow. Eventually, the band's outsized drug and alcohol use was becoming an increasing problem, and they split up in 1976 for 3 years, and again in 1982 for five, said the New York Times. Betts focused on solo projects until the group reunited, yet his reckless behavior never ceased. He was arrested in 1996 for aiming a gun at his wife, and finally the band fired him in 2000 for his drinking. Betts retired soon after and later said that what he'd most loved about his career was performing live. The crowd got more out of the music than I did, he said. I just really get a kick out of the audience and how they could just kind of drift away to another world. Here's a health and science piece. Evening exercise is best. Working out in the evening rather than the morning may help you live longer. That's the conclusion of a new study by researchers in Australia, reports the New York Post. The researchers looked at the health data from nearly 30,000 obese people over 8 years. The participants wore activity trackers for 7 days nonstop, which allowed the researchers to group them into those who tended to move more in the morning, afternoon, or evening. After accounting for lifestyle factors such as smoking, alcohol consumption, and sedentary time, they found that the evening exercisers were less likely to suffer from everything from minor heart problems to death. It didn't have to be a full workout either. Any type of movement showed benefit, as long as it got the heart rate up for a few minutes. Exercise is by no means the only solution to the obesity crisis, said lead researcher Matthew Amati from the University of Sydney. But this research does suggest that people who can plan their activity into certain times of the day may best offset some of those health risks. And we've got time for a couple of the Talking Points articles. Start with 2024, will Trump and Biden debate? President Biden must ignore the network news execs pushing him to debate Donald Trump, said David Frum in The Atlantic. In a joint statement, 12 news organizations last week called on the two candidates to commit to a pre-election debate, saying the televised event would be a competition of ideas where they could argue their policies with each other and before the American people. That'd be fine if both men were normal candidates, but one is an aspiring autocrat willing to use violence as a political tool. After losing the vote in 2020, Trump incited a mob to attack a Capitol, hoping his supporters would terrorize, kidnap, or even kill his own vice president to stop Biden's victory from being certified. This conspiracy to overthrow the Constitution is the only issue that should matter in November. It's not something to be debated alongside inflation or immigration policy. Imagine hearing Anderson Cooper attempt this pivot. We'll get to Mr. Trump's alleged violent coup in a moment, but in this segment, we are discussing food prices. Joe must say no. Trump has already indicated he wants to debate, said Zachary Faria in Washington Examiner. The question is whether the 81-year-old Biden, who's been noncommittal so far, has the stamina and mental acuity to take part in a two-hour-long forum. Sure, the Democrat can skip the event and claim he's doing so to defend democracy, but if Biden chooses not to go toe-to-toe with a rambling, mediocre debater in Trump, it'll only prove he is unfit for office. Look, Trump is a giant hypocrite for skipping the GOP primary debates and then insisting that Biden has an obligation to debate him, said Jim Garrity in National Review. But Biden has already bailed on the softball traditional pre-Super Bowl interview twice. If he fails to appear at an autumn debate, undecided voters will regard it as Biden waving the white flag of surrender. Why should Biden give Trump a platform to spew misinformation or conspiracy theories to a larger audience? Ask Marcella Garcia in the Boston Globe. And did anyone learn anything from their 2020 debates where Trump ranted over Biden, prompting the Democrat to say, "Will you shut up, man?" 4 years later, most voters have fixed opinions about Trump and Biden. The few remaining undecided Americans have plenty of other places to get informed about the candidates, news sites, policy documents, where the fate of democracy isn't treated like a reality show. So if this is the end of the televised presidential debate, all I can say is good riddance. Homelessness, should it be illegal? Can municipalities make it a crime to sleep outdoors? That's the question the Supreme Court debated this week in what could lead to its most significant ruling on homelessness in decades, said Ann E. Marimau and Rice Thibault in the Washington Post. The case centers on three ordinances in the town of Grants Pass, Oregon, that ban camping or sleeping on public property and using blankets or cardboard for warmth. Punishments include a $295 fine, with additional fines and jail for nonpayment. Lawyers for homeless residents argued that since Grants Pass doesn't offer adequate shelter space, the ordinances criminalize homelessness itself and thus violate the constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. During oral arguments, the Supreme Court's conservative majority expressed reluctance to micromanage local laws on the homeless, but acknowledged it might be unfair to punish people who have no choice but to sleep outdoors. Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked what homeless people should do when night comes. Are they supposed to kill themselves, not sleeping? Actually, it's homeless encampment culture that's cruel and unusual punishment, said Stephen Ide in National Review. In the U.S., about 300,000 people sleep outdoors every night. And on the West Coast in particular, many have set up massive tent cities that are hotbeds of drug taking, untreated mental illness, and crime. The people sleeping in them are exposed to theft, assault, and disease. The Constitution isn't a suicide pact, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Outdoor homeless camps are a threat to public safety, and local officials have a right to protect their citizens. It's no surprise that the justices struggled with the issue, said Matt Ford in the New Republic. Even conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett seemed torn, noting that a ban on sleeping outdoors would only shunt homeless people or other poor out of your jurisdiction and onto others. Liberal Justice Elena Kagan argued that homelessness is a status, not an act that can be punished. For a homeless person who has no place to go, sleeping in public is kind of like breathing in public, Kagan said. No one expects the Supreme Court's decision to solve the country's homelessness crisis, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. But allowing cities and towns to ban sleeping outdoors will do nothing to help people who lack housing or make them disappear. And some of the shorter notes. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received some 36 million reports of online child abuse in 2023, up 12% over the previous year. Most reports related to the circulation of photos and videos of child sexual abuse. 4,700 of those images and videos were created with the use of generative artificial intelligence. Complaints of pregnant women being turned away from emergency rooms spiked after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. A month after the decision, a woman in Texas miscarried in an ER lobby restroom after front desk staff refused to check her in. In North Carolina, a woman gave birth in her car after being refused an ultrasound. The baby later died. Fears of legal liability in states with strict abortion bans have made pregnant patients radioactive to ERs, said health law expert Sarah Rosenbaum. Since 2021, at least five states have passed laws that say school and public librarians can be imprisoned or fined for handing out obscene or harmful books to children. 17 other states are considering such measures. Under an Arkansas bill passed last year, librarians can be imprisoned for up to 6 years or fined $10,000. Readership of the 10 largest right-wing websites dropped 40% from February 2020 to this February, according to The Writing, a website that tracks conservative media. The Daily Wire lost 44% of its readership, The Daily Caller 57%, and The Federalist 91%. On the poll watch, 50% of Americans, including 47% of independents and 15% of Republicans, say they will consider Donald Trump unfit to be president if he's convicted of falsifying business documents to conceal hush money payments. And we'll finish today with a couple of quotes. Journalist David Brinkley says, "A successful man is one who can lay a firm foundation with the bricks others have thrown at him." And Phyllis Diller says, "They say housework can't kill you, but why take a chance?" And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And, as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.